Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. Bitcoin maximalism is toxic. It's you're just a maximalist because you're closed-minded and you can't learn because you're religious about Bitcoin. We hear this kind of stuff all the time. And yet my personal experience was it was a multi-year process in my 8 years or so being in this space to really digesting and fully understanding the Bitcoin maximalist argument. And it was not at all fun. I had to be very open-minded about things that I thought made intuitive sense, that like the default assumption, like a good example of big blocks. Like that's the easiest, most thoughtless way to increase the transaction throughput of Bitcoin. And it doesn't require you to consider anything. It's just blatantly obvious. If you've been here for 10 minutes and somebody says, oh, well, we could have a bigger block, and you know what the hell a block size is, that's just what you would think. Rather than being the closed-minded position, it's the one that I had to convince myself of after a lot of learning and hard work. So I thought it might be really good and lead to a really fun discussion to cover an article on the show. This one is by Ben Perrin. That's BTC Sessions on Twitter and YouTube. And if you're not following him, he is a great follower to have. And I met him actually at the Bitcoin 2019 conference. Had a lot of fun, really great guy. And we have not read anything of his on the show before, but he posted this on the medium.com page of Bull Bitcoin. And he wrote a great little article titled My Path to Bitcoin Maximalism. And that is what we're going to read today on The Cryptoeconomy with Guy Swan. That's what you're listening to. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we're going to do a little bit more reading today. This is the show where we read and go through all of the best content out there. There are so many great articles and critical pieces of, you know, cypherpunk history and even posts and stuff that just have a lot of meaning and a lot of depth and bring interesting perspectives to this space that let us explore Bitcoin and the cryptoeconomy from 1,000 different angles so that we can see and understand it from every perspective. And that's what this show is about. And that's what we are going to do today. We are going to read Ben Perrin's or BTC Sessions article, My Path to Bitcoin Maximalism. Don't forget, if you're going to join me at the BitBlock Boom, the Bitcoin Maximalist Conference down in Dallas on August 17th and 18th, do not forget to use the discount code CC. That will save you 30% off your tickets. But without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into this article, and then we will expand and talk about this idea as well as my own trip down the Bitcoin maximalist rabbit hole a little bit afterward. All right, so let's jump in to My Path to Bitcoin Maximalism by Ben Perrin. One of the biggest criticisms I hear when it comes to my Bitcoin maximalist beliefs is that I'm being closed-minded. Detractors tend to say that being dismissive of all other protocols shows stubbornness and an unwillingness to learn. Quite to the contrary, I've found that as I've built my knowledge base over the years, I've been able to compile a simple list of criteria that no coin other than Bitcoin has held a candle to. Today, I'm going to break down that list. So you're skeptical of my skepticism? I'm a little skeptical of that. First, I'd like to address what drew me to Bitcoin in the first place. I've distilled it down to a few key points. The separation of money and state, censorship resistance, and sound money. As I made my way down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, it became pretty evident to me that these were the items, in my opinion, that mattered the most. Once upon a time, during the gold standard, these principles were a societal norm. Unfortunately, a combination of human complacency and gold lacking certain necessary features resulted in a decline and eventual abolition of the gold standard. What follows is a brief history lesson that helped me recognize the value of these 3 points above, as well as the subsequent list of criteria I believe are necessary to achieve them. A little history. Physical gold was indeed sound money, not controlled by any one state, and offered censorship resistance. Two things that weren't inherent with gold were transportability and widely accessible or affordable secure self-storage. This led to third-party storage solutions, banks. Depositors would receive a certificate that they could redeem for their gold at a later date. For convenience sake, it became the norm for individuals to transact with gold certificates rather than withdrawing and redepositing the physical gold itself. The resulting convenience also gave way to a host of problems. Gold in the hands of a third party could not easily be audited. This gave the bank the ability to issue loans via certificates for more gold than they currently had access to. Fractional reserve banking. Only a fraction of the issued gold certificates would be represented by real gold reserves in a vault. If depositors got spooked into a bank run and enough people redeemed their certificates simultaneously, you could be left holding a worthless piece of paper even if you had been the one to originally deposit the gold. A mixture of complacency and laziness seemed to have resulted in an over-reliance on third parties to hold one's wealth, which in turn inevitably led down another dark road, easy confiscation. In 1933, President Roosevelt made it illegal for U.S. citizens to hold gold bars or certificates, and in under a month, confiscated nearly all privately held gold. Dissenters faced $10,000 fines and 5 to 10 years in prison. Upon relinquishing their gold, citizens were paid out a rate of $20 per ounce for their holdings. At this point, citizens had been robbed of their right to directly or indirectly hold any gold, but at least they still had sound money backed by gold, right? Not so fast. With the inability to hold gold, transact with it freely, or easily audit the third-party custodian, now the Federal Reserve, regular people now had no say in the underlying rules and pricing mechanisms governing their money. They were no longer holding the money themselves. After all, they were holding an asset pegged to sound money, gold. The peg itself was 100% in control of a centralized entity. Care to guess what happened next? The Gold Reserve Act of 1934 saw all gold confiscated the previous year surrendered to the U.S. Treasury. The kicker? Gold was repriced at $35 an ounce. This means that overnight, the dollar was devalued against gold by nearly half. Many countries over the coming decades relied on the U.S. to house their gold in its vaults in exchange for U.S. dollars, now the world reserve currency. The spiral of fractional reserve lending continued on, this time on an international stage. It became obvious that the U.S. was lending out more dollars than gold backing it, and soon countries like Switzerland and France caught wind of this. They began to demand their gold back, basically a bank run between nations. In 1971, decades of complacency and compromise dealt its final blow to the gold standard. On August 15, 1971, President Richard Nixon announced the temporary, quote-unquote, suspension of U.S. dollar convertibility to gold. All dollars in existence were now backed by little more than the paper they were printed on. That convertibility suspension exists to this day, and the consequences of this action can be summed up in a single graphic. And he's got a graphic here of the value, the purchasing power of the dollar from 1971 to 2018, and then overlaid with the amount of currency in circulation. So from January 71 to June 2018, the U.S. money supply increased 32.3 times, and this was accompanied by an 84.1% drop in the purchasing power of the dollar. Price inflation is a direct consequence of increased money supply. End graphic. In summary, I believe the decline of the gold standard can be attributed to the complacency of individuals putting trust in third parties, difficulty auditing third parties, easy confiscation, gradual centralization of power, and the ease with which the rules could be changed, and the lack of recourse citizens had to prevent this. Now, let's get to that list. I know you were expecting a quick list about maximalism, but context is everything. I applaud you for reading this far. Let's go ahead and break down my criteria to achieve a new sound money standard, how I believe they will help prevent the mistakes of the past, and why no coin other than Bitcoin has been able to endure this test, at least in my eyes. 1. Is it sound money? For obvious reasons, this is high priority. What is the supply? How is it issued over time? Was it distributed fairly from the get-go? With Bitcoin, you get definitive answers out of all of these questions, and the answers all tend to imply yes. This protocol was built to mirror the properties of a sound money like gold. Without diving too deep into the technicals, you can sum it up relatively quickly here. There will only ever be 21 million coins. Coins are issued on a gradually diminishing inflation schedule that halves production roughly every 4 years. Newly created coins, along with transaction fees paid by network users, are rewarded roughly every 10 minutes to individuals called miners who vet and organize transactions that adhere to the consensus rules of the network. Sadly, though, with my experience working in an OTC brokerage, I know that many, quote, crypto investors have zero knowledge of these basic properties when it comes to Bitcoin, let alone altcoins. I suppose that's why coins like Ethereum have technically illiterate individuals buying it out of speculation, despite the fact that there has never been a clear monetary policy, and that the decision-making procedure around issuance tends to more closely mirror that of a central bank, Vitalik and the Ethereum Foundation, than a decentralized network coming to consensus on hard rules. It would also explain why a coin like Ripple, XRP, that was printed out of nothing and sold to a clueless public, still retains a ravenous mob of people convinced it will hit $589 per coin. This despite there being 100 billion units, with 60% still in the possession of Ripple Labs, to be dumped on the market at regular intervals. Supply and issuance are more or less the bedrocks of my reasoning in this list, while the rest of my points tend to center around how I can be sure these metrics will not and cannot be changed. 2. Are transactions borderless and censorship resistant? A pretty simple requirement here. If I have sound money, then I also want to be able to bring it with me anywhere and send it to anyone. The main coins that will most clearly fail here are fiat stablecoins created by corporations in jurisdictions with heavy regulatory oversight. JP Morgan coin, Facebook's Libra, and others like it will certainly be subject to full KYC AML and forced into the creaky framework set up decades ago by the legacy banking system. Luckily, they're pegged to fiat dollars anyway, so they're already out of the running after failing the sound money test. We're not out of the woods yet, though. As much as people tout blockchain as being a magical, censorship-resistant, immutable record, that's only as true as the consensus mechanism governing the chain. How is it decided who actually owns what? We've definitely seen examples of reversed transactions on supposedly decentralized blockchains. EOS has already regularly reversed previously confirmed and supposedly immutable transactions, sometimes without initially giving any reason at all. BAT, Basic Attention Token, is able to reclaim, in other words, steal your coins if you forgot to use them within 90 days. Even if you believe Ethereum to be sufficiently decentralized to achieve immutability at this point, which is debatable, that does not mean your ERC-20 token, a coin built on top of the Ethereum blockchain, is immutable. Each token built atop another blockchain has its own set of consensus rules, which can include the ability to reverse transactions. 3. Is it sufficiently decentralized and secure? This is where things get tricky for the uninitiated. A coin can claim to be immutable and anti-censorship all it wants, but in the end, if there is not enough global computing power backing that claim up, their word is not worth the white paper it's written on. To me, there's no better example of this than Ethereum Classic. A few years back, there was a project called the DAO, or DAO, built on Ethereum. It boasted it would be a revolution in corporate structure, with no CEOs, crowdsourced decision-making, and the ability to splinter into different corporations if some individuals disagreed with the trajectory. People got excited, perhaps a little too excited, especially when it comes to untested code. In less than a month, 11,000 investors piled $150 million into the project. Lo and behold, the code had loopholes, and an attacker was able to siphon off around $50 million. The ensuing shitstorm resulted in two camps. Those who wanted to reverse the hack and return the money to the original owners. This is what we know as Ethereum now. And those who believed that reversing transactions would compromise the very reason for using a blockchain in the first place. This group preferred to leave the funds be. A, quote, fork of the protocol was created and is now known as Ethereum Classic, though technically speaking, it is the original chain. Ethereum Classic has always prided itself for its values and immutability. If your transaction is on the blockchain, you should be sure that it will still be there tomorrow and every day thereafter. There's one little hitch, though. Ethereum Classic didn't have the hash power to back that up. In brief, hash power is the amount of computing power on the network ensuring that transactions are relayed and recorded indefinitely. When this power is distributed amongst a large number of peers, everything tends to work swimmingly. However, when more than 51% of this hash power centralizes in the hands of a single entity, they gain the ability to potentially reverse previously confirmed transactions and replace them with new ones. The more hashing power, the easier it is to pull off the attack. This came to fruition for Ethereum Classic on January 7th, 2019, when an individual or group of people was able to successfully double spend around $1.1 million worth of ETC as they 51% attacked the chain. The long and short of it, they were able to deposit Ethereum Classic on exchanges, trade for other coins, withdraw, and then reverse their ETC deposit from ever happening. Ethereum Classic isn't the only large chain to experience attacks like this. Verge, Vertcoin, Bitcoin Gold, and Feathercoin have all been 51% attacked, just to name a few. 4. Is it leaderless? Or is there a clear corporation or figurehead behind it? Let's be crystal clear here. This is not something I'm looking for. Having leadership in any form, perceived or actual, is a detriment to a global cryptocurrency. Leaders are fallible, coercible, and corruptible. Bestowing faith and power upon a leader defers the responsibility of thinking and decision-making to someone else. Even a supposedly moral person in a position of power can act against the free market in the interest of the greater good when in reality they're simply favoring short-term gain. Leaders can also say stupid things or make stupid mistakes that impact the market. Furthermore, all of these scenarios assume your leadership doesn't have straight-up malicious intentions. If none of the other points have picked off your chosen coin thus far, this one is fairly likely to apply. Think of all the easily identifiable figureheads in crypto. Charlie Lee with Litecoin, Vitalik Buterin with Ethereum, Brad Garlinghouse and David Schwartz with Ripple, XRP. Regardless of the character of these individuals, each one is given a sort of deity position in their respective communities. When they say jump, a chorus of altcoiners respond with, how high? Hey, at least they're not this guy. He's got a link to a satirical article that claims the Guinness World Record awarded Dan Larimer for the highest number of crypto exit scams. The original article that the link is talking about is from Coin Jazeera, which is kind of like the Onion of the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency space. Before we jump back into this piece, though, on part five of the list, let's go ahead and hit our sponsor real quick, and I will take a break and grab myself something to drink, and we will come right back. Five, how easy is it to make non-backwards compatible changes to the protocol? One of the foundational principles of cryptocurrency, or Bitcoin at least, is consensus. A group of individuals coming together and agreeing upon a set of rules that govern the protocol. Don't follow the rules? Your transactions are rejected and you are ignored. This beckons back to something I mentioned in point number one. How can I be sure that the principles of sound money in a cryptocurrency's protocol will be upheld? Many Bitcoin critics like to point to the fact that it is slow to change, and other chains are much more nimble when implementing upgrades. Hell, one of the slogans of Ethereum is, move fast and break things. Non-backwards compatible upgrades, or hard forks, have become commonplace on coins like Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash, Dash, and others. My issue with this is simply that it sets a dangerous precedent. When the bedrock of your currency, its underlying rule set, is trivial to change, then all of the promises you've come to put your trust in are malleable. While many think the 21 million coin limit is an untouchable metric, I would venture to say that at one point the idea of leaving the gold standard seemed to be an equally preposterous idea. In my opinion, the sooner the Bitcoin protocol ossifies, the better. I have no interest in jeopardizing Bitcoin's nearly spotless decade-long track record because of a knee-jerk reaction to buying coffee becoming impractical for short periods of time. So what about adding features and scaling for transactional demand? I'm confident in the ability of base layer optimization in combination with layer 2 solutions in order to achieve this. Lightning Network launched on mainnet in March of 2018, and the amount of growth in that time has been staggering. Additions to the protocol like Neutrino, Submarine Swaps, and Atomic Multipath payments will make the user's experience much more seamless over time. Taproot, RGB Protocol, and Liquid are all examples that expand Bitcoin's ability to do things like smart contracts and pegged digital assets built atop its own blockchain. In short, I see things developing atop Bitcoin without bloating the base layer or creating the need for frequent hard forks. I think this is the best approach to scaling, and I will outline my reasons why in the final criteria I've set out. Number 6. Can users self-validate and follow the consensus rules with minimal cost? One of the most important aspects of Bitcoin is the ability of any individual to independently validate and follow the consensus rules of their choosing. I cannot stress how important this is. To reference the beginning of this piece, complacency and a lack of personal responsibility led to centralized entities gaining control of the consensus mechanisms around gold. The rules were changed on everyone and they saw their savings confiscated and devalued in one fell swoop. As it stands right now, it is relatively trivial for someone with a computer and an internet connection to download an entire copy of the blockchain and vet the entirety of Bitcoin's transaction history themselves. It is also trivial for someone to continue running the Bitcoin software and know beyond a shadow of a doubt that no one else can force different consensus rules upon them. This is due in part to the block size limit and the continual work of developers to optimize the base layer, keeping it accessible to everyday users. In contrast, the Ethereum blockchain has ballooned out of control, surpassing 1 terabyte in May of 2018. Storing it isn't the primary issue, though. It's latency. Trying to sync a node with so much data being relayed is a veritable nightmare, which in turn has centralized validators. I don't necessarily think that everyone always needs to run a node, but I am firm in my belief that it should always be an option. When you do not run a Bitcoin node, you are trusting someone else to tell you what Bitcoin is. That's fine and dandy when there are no contentious issues on the table, but when shit hits the fan, you run the risk of being forced into a rule change that you don't want. The development around optimizing Bitcoin's base layer to make it more accessible to the masses is what I believe to be this protocol's greatest strength. To date, the best example of this has been the defeat of SegWit2x. Quick recap. In 2017, a large number of industry-leading companies, BitPay, Coinbase, Blockchain.info, Shapeshift, and more, plus a majority of Bitcoin miners, decided they would create a non-backwards compatible fork of Bitcoin to scale the network. The new coin would be called Bitcoin, and the old chain would be abandoned. In a spectacular show of defiance, Bitcoiners rejected this, quote, upgrade to the network. With nothing more than their own privately run nodes and some top-notch game theory, individual users defeated every major company in the space and forced them into a position where they backed down less than 24 hours before the proposed fork. For me, this was the single most bullish moment in Bitcoin's history. Across any other industry, a result like this is nearly unprecedented. This is Bitcoin's strength. The ability of individual users to stand up against all odds and flip the bird to the establishment when they come in trying to, quote, fix Bitcoin. Conclusion. My path to Bitcoin maximalism was not born out of closed-mindedness, but rather a careful consideration of what properties attracted me to Bitcoin and what conditions I believe are necessary to preserve those properties. I want a protocol that embodies the principles of sound money, is borderless and censorship resistant, exhibits sufficient decentralization, has no discernible figurehead or leader, is incredibly difficult to change in a non-backwards compatible way, and preserves the ability of any individual to validate and follow the consensus rules. I found distilling my interests and values down to these points has given me focus. A failure on any single one of these points is a non-starter, and this has become my litmus test for blockchain bullshit. Outside of Bitcoin, I've yet to see another coin clear these hurdles, and until I see evidence to the contrary, I'm inclined to believe that Bitcoin is the only protocol that will. All right, and that closes out BTC Sessions, or Ben Perrin's piece, My Path to Bitcoin Maximalism. And I just thought this hit a ton of great stuff. And what's even better is that the points that he laid out, like the strict rules with which he was judging Bitcoin and all other altcoins by, which I think are a very common set of rules. Like if I had to actually break it down and piece it out, it would basically be that same list. And Hasu Fly actually had in one of the Medium articles that he and Suzu did I think it's unpacking Bitcoin's social contract lays out a similar set of rules that are really just variations on this same thing. It's the no confiscation, no censorship, no inflation, and then anyone can verify the first three rules. Like they just basically summed up the exact same thing in, you know, four characteristics, where this one kind of breaks it up a little bit and makes it more specific. But I think most any Bitcoin maximalist will basically tell you these things. And like, I know I came into Bitcoin maximalism in a very similar way, is that like I had to stop when all these altcoins, I admit I got excited about these other projects. I was actually really excited about the very first altcoin, Namecoin, seemed extremely interesting to me as a way to decentralize DNS. And I got super excited. I mean, from somebody who comes from the whole space and like the entire interest is in decentralization, and which is the foundation of the idea of the crypto economy. All of those things were very exciting to me. All the projects, like I went in and jumped in. I was reading white papers through all of this. I started thinking I was going to write up, you know, explanations of like the top 100 coins and stuff. But I kept running into these things that just felt like it wasn't working somehow, that something was wrong. And for the longest time, I couldn't quite pinpoint it. So I had to ask myself, when all these Bitcoin Unlimited and SegWit2x, like all of this stuff was happening, I had to work really hard to figure out like what my position was. Like, why did I feel awkward about this, that, or the other? Like, what seemed incorrect to it about me? And what was it that I actually cared about in the protocol? What was it, like, what are the values of Bitcoin that I think make it powerful? Because if I am giving those things up, then whatever the other, you know, problem being solved on top of that is uninteresting, because you've lost the foundation that differentiates it from, you know, some other alternative. So let's go a couple. I highlighted a number of really great things in this Medium post that I particularly thought. First, I just wanted to say that his like three paragraph summation of the SegWit2x thing is absolutely wonderful. I've had a really hard time trying to make that thing make sense in the Bitcoin holiday calendar. I've actually edited my own like a couple of times, and I might actually just use this excerpt. So if BTC sessions, if you actually listen to this, I'm probably going to shoot you a message just to get permission. But I think I want to, let me just read it really quick. I just thought this was great. Where are you at? And you're down here somewhere. Okay, quick recap. In 2017, a large number of industry-leading companies, BitPay, Coinbase, Blockchain.info, Shapeshift, and more, plus a majority of the Bitcoin miners, decided that they would create a non-backwards compatible fork of Bitcoin to scale the network. The new coin would be called Bitcoin, and the old chain would be abandoned. In a spectacular show of defiance, Bitcoiners rejected this upgrade to the network. With nothing more than their own privately run nodes and some top-notch game theory, individual users defeated every major company in the space and forced them into a position where they backed down less than 24 hours before the proposed fork. For me, this was the single most bullish moment in Bitcoin's history. Across any other industry, a result like this is nearly unprecedented. This is Bitcoin's strength. The ability of individual users to stand up against all odds and flip the bird to the establishment when they come in trying to, quote, fix Bitcoin. Happy Bitcoin Independence Day. Like, that is, that I just saw that was three great paragraphs that break down everything that happened throughout 2017. That entire summer leading up to that was admittedly really nerve-wracking, and it was crazy to see it actually play out. And I love that. I thought that was a great little section there. But in the end, with his entire argument, I thought this was an excellent, excellent defense of Bitcoin maximalism, and gives an incredibly clear and simple set of rules to follow to say, if you want to prove me wrong, if you want me to be open-minded, challenge, let your coin or your system, whatever it is that you think, you know, is the better, challenge Bitcoin on any, on, in fact, on every one of these characteristics, because this is exactly what I judge by. And the truth is, if Bitcoin shows that it cannot, like, maintain one of these and something else can, I would be just as excited about that. It is the rules. It is these characteristics that make Bitcoin fascinating and powerful. If it turns out, I don't see how at this point, but if it turns out that there is basically a weakness in, you know, the governance or the 51% model, whatever it is, that something else can solve, then I'm all for it. I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist in the sense that that I will hold on to Bitcoin as it, you know, goes to zero. I'm a Bitcoin maximalist in the sense that I have thought incredibly deeply about this and all the alternatives, and Bitcoin is the only one that comes close. And BTC Sessions just has a great breakdown of all of these points. We'll go through them really quick. It embodies the principles of sound money. That has been one of my issues with almost the idea of every altcoin. So many do not seem concerned with the hardness of the monetary policy. A lot of them are just have like a payout that goes indefinitely. Like even back in the day, I would be like, oh, it would be fun to invest in Dogecoin because it sounds like it could be fun. And, you know, maybe this will be a multi-currency universe and there'll be tons of these projects. But that inflation rate looks doo-doo. You know, I was deep into Austrian economics, and that was the very first thing that fascinated me about Bitcoin, is that it is an incredibly sound monetary policy and it cannot be changed. It is set in the protocol and it will exist until people stop running the protocol. And that was what took my brother and me down the rabbit hole day one. So pretty much any project that doesn't hold that at the forefront is really uninteresting to me, because there were things that could have existed before Bitcoin. You know, like it just, like that, I believe the solution that is sound money, the technology that is sound money, the additional efficiency, liberties, and economic balance and stability that we will get from an economy that has actual sound money, I don't think anything else can grant the level of utility and incredible growth in wealth and productivity that an economy has under sound money. There is no other technology that can solve our problems that we have, the largest problems that we have right now, faster and better than having a sound money. I think so many of our problems are deeply worsened, some are directly caused, and some are just two or three orders away from the problems that are caused by bad money. So if this, you know, whatever altcoin project or programmable blockchain project, whatever it is, if it is not interested in sound money, then it is not interested in 99% of the significance that this technology is. And, you know, maybe that extra 1% could be fun, but if it's not interested in sound money, then it's not trying to fix the problems we have today. Because I think the loss of sound money is where so much of our waste and corruption, abuse, and injustice comes from. Okay, so next, is borderless and censorship resistant. Kind of on the same page. If this thing's not global, what's interesting about it? If it's not global, if it's not changing and disrupting the current order of things, like the current borders in the world, if this doesn't open this up to more people, if it isn't a liberating technology, then, you know, what is it? Like, okay, so we can get like a little bit of like what, faster transactions like in the economy? Like what are we getting if we are not lifting barriers and problems that we have today? We're talking about a currency that, if it remains borderless and censorship resistant, can solve some of the most terrible atrocities in the world, that can give people an escape, not solve, because atrocities are human consequences, they're human action, but a technology that can increase the barrier to profit from those terrible actions and can increase the or decrease the barrier to resisting or escaping those actions. Any technology that can do that can start a trend and create incentives to solve these problems in the long term. That when somebody cannot be led to starve to death because the Indian government wants to devalue their currency because they have been responsible, so they will gladly force their citizens to use their currency while they absolutely destroy its value and happily watch them starve to death because they have purposefully given no out for the citizen. That's a terrible thing. If we can have a technology that can give them an out in spite of terrible people and terrible actions like this, then we begin to move the world in a significant way to greater autonomy, greater sovereignty, greater liberty, greater health, greater financial stability. Like, all of these things can actually be achieved, and we don't have to fix India's government to do it. We are eliminating the attack vectors that they have that they can exploit that cause these massive problems. These are all networks. These are all like human programs of organization, and they have attack vectors. And when that attack vector or third party or honeypot or whatever is left exposed, then it will get exploited to someone else's gain. So that leads us on to three, exhibit sufficient decentralization. Now, a lot of these are, it's funny, all of these really have the same effect, or they really share one characteristic, like embodies the principles of sound money. Well, I guess technically that's a standalone, because you could have all the independence and censorship resistance without sound money. But borderless, censorship resistant, exhibits sufficient decentralization, has no discernible figurehead or leader, and is incredibly difficult to change. All of those really are a form of, are characteristics that create independence, that make this, whatever this thing is, you know, the money or the network, the protocol, make it entirely independent of any particular set or group of people, that it is kind of standalone because it's sufficiently decentralized. It is borderless and censorship resistant. It is sufficiently decentralized because it has no discernible figurehead or leader. And because it's sufficiently decentralized, it's incredibly difficult to change in a non-backwards compatible way. So all of these really go hand in hand. And I think, I mean, I completely agree that these are 100% critical. I think if any one of these characteristics are changed, then you probably have lost the other ones. They're kind of interdependent on each other in that way. But the decentralization problem is obviously not clear. Like, that's one of those things that's very, very difficult to measure or quantify in any way. And he kind of like alludes to this right here at the beginning. I'll actually read this paragraph because I highlighted it. Is it sufficiently decentralized and secure? Well, this is where things get tricky for the uninitiated. A coin can claim to be immutable and anti-censorship all at once, but in the end, if there is not enough global computing power backing that claim up, their word is not worth the white paper it's written on. To me, there's no better example of this than Ethereum Classic. And here's the problem with the idea of whether or not it's sufficiently decentralized is that really the only way you can find out is to test it, is to poke it in a way that, you know, the centralized response would be something. Like, it really just has to come to, like, I think the DAO was Ethereum's test and Ethereum failed, and SegWit2x was Bitcoin's test and Bitcoin succeeded. And I truly believe that that is, I mean, just like Ben said, like, that is the ultimate differentiator to me. Is that, like, I do not think that any other coin, like, if your coin doesn't have that, then it's, again, none of the other stuff is interesting because all of the other stuff can just be changed. So that and the inability to create backwards compatible. Again, those are sort of interchangeable, right? Like they really depended on each other. If it's not sufficiently decentralized, well, then probably someone or some institution may be able to, or a group of companies and institutions has the power to force a non-compatible alteration to the rules and, you know, essentially do a hostile takeover of the network consensus. So that one's really hard to define. I think decentralization is a multifaceted aspect. And like, for instance, we have incredible minor decentralization on the network, but we have very centralized mining pools on the Bitcoin network. It only takes like four or five, or no, I think it's like six actually, to get like a decent majority of the hash power to perform something like a 51% attack. And that's the nature of the, that's why we talked about BetterHash. If you haven't listened to the BetterHash episode, I definitely recommend it, because I honestly think, coming from like a measurement standpoint or a looking at the network position, that is the biggest point of quantifiable non-decentralization, centralization in the Bitcoin system. That is actually incredibly easy to fix, and we have the solution already. It's simply that we're kind of complacent. Like he talks about, like, you know, the problem with gold was complacency, just like Ben talked about, that the problem with the gold standard and the gold certificate standard or whatnot was complacency and laziness. And that would be terrible to see us fall victim to such really an obvious attack that's been talked about since the white paper, and that we have a solution to, that BetterHash could actually remove the control that all of these huge pools have without negating the benefit of the pool. Like, the fact that that is not implemented is complacency and laziness. It's because nobody's really concerned about it. So I think that's a really, really important, like, I like that he basically points out or narrows down that really that was a big problem of it, that there was a way to resist and there was a way to take a small, a minor cost to get back some degree of that personal power. But it just wasn't done because everybody just kind of became complacent and they didn't stand up when they should have stood up. And we really kind of hit all four of those points back to back, really. And like I said, they're very interdependent on each other. So the borderless censorship resistance, sufficient decentralization, has no discernible figurehead or leader, and incredibly difficult to change in a non-backwards compatible way. And then that leads us to the fourth one, the validation. That anyone can participate, that everybody does the audit, that the ability of any individual to validate and secure the specific rules that they are following must be preserved. And that was what finally put me over the edge in the block size argument, is that I realized that if I cannot validate, like if we go right back to trusted third parties, if we used miners as the validators, if we considered them the only validators of the network, it would be like using coinage again in the banking certificate like world. Is that rather than, Nick Szabo talks about this in one of the pieces we read by him recently. I can't remember what the name of it is. I'll put it in the show notes though. But he talks about how, like, on every gold and silver transaction, it was too difficult, it was too complicated, and it was too annoying to assay the gold, to verify that the metal was fully the metal and the weight that it was supposed to be. And so instead, you would just trust the coinage, you would just trust that third party. And people got burned, and this became an attack vector. Again, if the attack vector exists, and particularly if it's in the hands of monopolistic political institutions, they will abuse the crap out of it to do whatever it is that they want to or can do because of that. So, like, if you leave that open, you're going to get gold coins that are full of lead and tungsten. And in that same way, if we just trust the hash power and nobody is actually validating, well, then how would you Like, what would be the network level defense against something like SegWit 2x? What would it be? Nothing. You wouldn't be able to, their transactions would confirm on all the exchanges. Like, the fact that everybody is running validating nodes regardless of whether or not they're mining means that these invalid blocks and transactions can't get into the network. It won't reach the wallet, so the user will not even see that there was a transaction made on this alteration of the consensus rules. And the more full nodes we have, the greater that defense is, like Stop and Decrypt says. And the Bitcoin network is an impenetrable fortress of validation. And that is the, I think that's the crux of all of this. Even if it doesn't, even if it isn't sound money, and, you know, there's a lot of other, like, even if it was in the hands of a trusted third party, if I could validate and still freely choose to use or not use that trusted third party, it would still be an improvement. The ability to validate myself without question and know what rules I am following is absolutely critical to the very idea of what makes this decentralized at all. And again, like I said, these are all so deeply attached to each other. I don't think you can get decentralization without the ability to validate in a broad and individually defensive way. And if you don't have sufficient decentralization, it's going to be easy to change. It's not going to be borderless and censorship resistant. And if it's none of those things, it doesn't matter what characteristic it supposedly has right now. In the end, it will not embody the principle of sound money. So I think, I don't know, I thought this was just a really great defense of Bitcoin maximalism as an extremely meticulous and thoughtful perspective. The exact opposite of everything that it is laid out to be. So huge applause to BTC Sessions for this piece. I read it not very long at all after it was posted, just a couple of days, and I was immediately like, oh, this is gold. This is great. And I got really excited about it, so I've been eager to get to this one on the show. So do not forget to go to the Medium post and drop some major applause on this article. And if you had a particular piece or a particular paragraph or something that you wanted to highlight, don't forget that you can highlight and call attention to some of the really good stuff that he has in this one. So definitely don't forget to go check it out. I will have the Medium, the link to the Medium page in the show notes and on the Twitter post so that you can all check it out. And of course, follow Ben Perrin at BTC Sessions on both Twitter and YouTube. And I guess that will do us for today. Hope you guys enjoyed the discussion. I hope you guys enjoyed the great piece, My Path to Bitcoin Maximalism. And thank you for listening to The Cryptoeconomy with Guy Swan, where we read all about Bitcoin and the cryptoeconomy and the nature of these technologies and protocols and what kind of impact they will have on the world, and to look at these from all different disciplines and perspectives to explore this crazy new world that is being built. Thank you guys so much for joining me. And don't forget to follow at The Crypto Economy. Check me out on thecryptoeconomy.com and subscribe to the show so you don't miss any more great stuff. We got it coming every day, and we hit all of the best. I love you guys, and until next time, take it easy, everybody.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.